As Passover approaches, so does the Seder. How do we consider these four cups of wine and the way they affect our consciousness? That's something we're going to explore in this episode of The Jewish Drinking Show, bringing L'chaim to life. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan, and I'm very excited to welcome first-time guest of the show, Rabbi Zach Kamenetz. Rabbi Kamenetz, welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Absolutely. For those less familiar with Rabbi Kamenetz, he is a rabbi, community leader, and aspiring psychedelic assisted chaplain based in Berkeley, California. He holds an MA in biblical literature and languages from UC Berkeley and the Graduate Theological Union, and received rabbinic ordination from the head of the Jerusalem Rabbinical Court in 2012 as the founder and CEO of Shefa. Rabbi Kamenetz is pioneering a movement to integrate safe and supported psychedelic use into the Jewish spiritual tradition, advocate for individuals and communities to heal individual and inherited trauma, and inspire Jewish religious and creative renaissance in the 21st century. So that's a helpful biographical background. So, and we're going to be talking about some sort of interesting overlap, I would describe it, between what you're mentioning, psychedelics, and of course, what people come to the show for, drinking texts, and in the lead up for Passover. Of course, it's on everybody's minds. And although we all start freaking out about ridding ourselves of chametz and cleaning, there's also the excitement of the mandated minimum of four cups of wine at the Passover Seder. So that's an opportunity for us to discuss the Seder. Rabbi Kamenetz here, you have provided some fascinating possibilities of texts for us to explore. Hasidish, or not, the Kabbalistic texts?
Hasidic, well, the text that that I shared with you is from Likutei. Well, there's something from the Baal Shem Tov, but the real text that I want to share is from Likutei Halachot, specifically from Hilchot Pesach, that is written by Rav Nasson, but it is the teachings of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov.
Okay, so it is a Hasidic text.
Yes, it is a Hasidic text, but it is also just halacha.
It's a nice intersection.
Absolutely.
That seems to be our theme.
This is found in Hilchot Pesach, Or HaChaim, and Likutei Halachot. You can find it on Sefaria. And it says, wine raises the awareness. And awareness, I believe, is das here. Das as translated as awareness. Okay. Beyond its level. For this reason, one needs to drink wine in a state of great sacredness. And through it, one can receive holy guidance, truth, and faith. So this is a different way of talking about the four cups of wine on Pesach at the Seder, specifically for receiving here in the text. I think it says here, I'm having to go through the Hebrew, which I translated some of the some in English, but I think it's Eitza Emes and Amuna. Okay. Then, through drinking wine, one's consciousness can become elevated in holiness, and one can experience great passion for the blessed divine and be awakened to divine devotion. For since one's consciousness has been elevated and their awareness is expanded, they can ascend to the root of all awareness, which is the source of the Torah and commandments that transcends all of the Torah's commandments. I'll stop at the end of this sentence because it's a lot to unpack. And from which all of the commandments receive their vitality and illumination. Okay, so as a non-Hasidic, non-Kabbalistic person that you have told me that you are, what questions immediately come up from what we have just read so that maybe we can answer question and answer that way? Because this is new for you. Yeah. I've read it before. So what do you see that is curious to you?
Well, the first thing that is absolutely a non-curiosity, I love the instrumentality of wine here, that you're using it to elevate, which is fantastic. I think for me, which is fascinating, is this vitality and illumination that from which all the commandments receive their vitality and illumination. That's a fascinating piece of this.
That, I think, is an important point here, obviously. So let's imagine that the way that we practice the mitzvot from the Torah that we have, right? The mitzvot that we have are derived from the Torah that we have currently. Mm-hmm. But in certain Kabbalistic frames. Certainly Hasidic traditions are drawing from the earlier Kabbalistic traditions, that there is something called a supernal Torah, that there is something beyond human history, human consciousness, that it only exists alongside or with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, but it is connected to but different than our Torah and our mitzvot. They are connected, but one serves some eternal, supernal purpose, and the one that we have is conditioned by the fact that it was given to a particular people and a particular time in history. And that's very close to, I think, you told me that I don't think that you call yourself a Maimonidean, but your orientation is Maimonidean.
It's fairly rational. I would say fairly rationalistic.
So even in Morei Nevuchim, right? I think that is how the Rambam opens his Hagdama. That I could be wrong. It's been a long time, but the idea that the Torah that we have is historically conditioned. If it was given to us in 2023, it would look very different than it would whatever the year is that you would put on Har Sinai. So
it's like a contextualized version of that supernal Torah you were sharing.
Exactly. So here too, there is the idea that by drinking wine, we ascend from our historicized contextual position and in some ways elevate beyond that to something that is far more open, aware, and conscious than where we could be in this particular moment.
Okay. And so that's also the other question I was going to ask, which is this whole the root of all awareness, which is the source of the Torah and commandments that transcend, blah, 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 and then ultimately the everything receiving the vitality and illumination. But I guess you're packaging all that together, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yes, those things are connected, and the only reason that our Torah and mitzvot have chiyut, again, I can't, I
liveliness.
Chiyut, liveliness, vitality, and illumination, hara, probably somewhere in here. They draw down that supernal light and liveliness and are suffused with it, but are different in, order of magnitude by who can say. Therefore, on Passover, on Pesach, when the light of truth itself is revealed, which transcends all levels of the mind, there is an obligation to drink the four cups of wine. So interesting then, at least in this text, and in only this statement, the mitzvah of the Arba Kosot is for the purpose of transcending dot, from actually going through our consciousness and beyond it, to whatever lies beyond it, which, and in the Kabbalistic Eitz Chaim, that if we're actually like thinking about dat as being that point between Chokhmah and Bina, and beyond it, which is Keter, and above it is Ein Sof, that we are using dat, that awareness or mindfulness, to now transcend to levels of awareness which are beyond human capacity. And specifically, we do this through the mitzvah of drinking wine at the Seder.
Interesting. I know this is very, what you're saying is more of the intellectual bent. One thing that actually was fascinating to me was, please, previously it says, when one ascends to that level, one experiences great passion and strength to fulfill the Torah's commandments. So there's also this physical energy, also maybe this passion is more of a, I don't even know if it's intellectual energy, but you're inspired, I guess, which, I don't know that regular rationalist halachic whatever talk about passion or strength to do, like, you have to do it. But here it's saying you're getting energized to then go ahead and perform the mitzvot.
Yeah, thank you. I think I skipped over that when I was just continuing. I think the what's embedded in this text, and you know, if people, we can put the link to this short source sheet in Safari in the episode notes. But the idea of dvekut, the Hasidic practice of working one's way toward clinging to, infusing, being, had great ways of translating dvekut, and none of them are coming to me. Being cleaving, absorbed, what does it mean to cleave?
Cleaving. A connection.
Absorption. I would probably say absorption into divine unity. Yeah. Being absorbed into divine unity, where there is words like passion, and here it was hit lahavut, that the love for Kadosh Baruch Hu is so intense, like as a person would, be engulfed in the love for one's lover. We see that language also in the Rambam, that there is no distinction between the loved and the lover. And so in that way, we're getting close to, this kind of mysticism where the subject and the object of the object of desire and the one who is desiring, those boundaries fall away. Mm. And the only thing that exists is passion. The only thing that exists is light. The only thing that exists is truth. But that, of course, doesn't last. So when one achieves, well, it shouldn't last, because as the Besht would say in other places, if one spent one's time always in dvekut, they would just cease to exist. They would burn up, right? They would die. You can't do that. That's like Nadav and Avihu stuff, back to wine. That eventually one has to come back to this state of, lower consciousness. And then that is then, I think, in this text, when one goes out, right, another term, ratzo vashov, when one enters into that state of expanded awareness, ratzo, running toward Kadosh Baruch Hu, running toward awakening, then one has to eventually retreat. And with that retreat, it infuses, as you said, it gives one strength and passion to continue to fulfill the Torah's commandments.
Hey there, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far with Rabbi Kamenetz. And speaking of Passover, I wanted to take a sneak peek into next week's episode featuring Dan Rabinowitz.
There really is no attempt to minimize this or to try to only use it as like a last resort. Mm. It has become, as I said, like Rabbi Asher says, you actually must study your chametz. Like it has shifted from b'diavad to lechachila, right? I mean, and lechachila in a way that there seems to be no downward pressure on the idea that you should attempt to minimize this as much as possible, because if you contrast that with what the Torah says, there is a tension, to say the least, between the two.
I hope you enjoyed that sneak peek featuring Dan Rabinowitz. We'll be coming out next week. Now back into this episode with Rabbi Kamenetz.
Back to the text here. So this is where we get the obligation to drink the four cups of wine. For it is now specifically through wine that one's consciousness can be elevated to receive the light of truth itself, which is the light of all consciousness that transcends and precedes the vessels of our consciousness. So what could this mean?
Yes.
What could this mean? That the light of truth. What's the light of truth?
Is it this supernal Torah that you were referencing before?
I believe so. Right. It's, in the language that we could potentially actually even begin to understand, right? If there is something called truth, and maybe that's just because it's another name for the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and what emanates from Emet itself is light, right? Something that we can perceive around it. And that light, which is the light of all consciousness that transcends and precedes the vessels of our consciousness, we have consciousness. The fact that you and I are speaking words, understanding words, we're relating to each other, we're feeling the room that we're in, right? This is the consciousness that we happen to have. But what exists beyond it? Is there something that exists beyond that consciousness? And so, in, at least in this text, there is, and our consciousness is connected, is indebted to a consciousness that exists beyond ours. And so when we drink wine in this way, we somehow are able to meet that kind of awareness that we could not without having drunk this much or in this way.
In that broader consciousness is a greater consciousness of humanity. Is that God's consciousness? Is it some sort of that supernal consciousness of the Torah, maybe? So which might that be? Or it's just a broader consciousness.
Good question. I think that's we only have questions here. I don't. I mean, let's imagine that. Is it an abstract consciousness? I doubt it could be the consciousness of divinity in its totality. Mm-hmm. But maybe it is in that way, right? Coming to that higher mirror consciousness that, right? There's the dot of my own unique individual consciousness. And then through the drinking, I meet that supernal kind of consciousness, which is not divine consciousness. I then come back down to my singular consciousness, but having been re-suffused, reignited with something that lies beyond me. In some ways, it feels like a little bit like a conversation, like the Force. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you talk about Star Wars on this show, maybe sometimes.
Not much. I know a lot about Star Wars.
Well, that's why I mentioned it. But okay. Is there, you know, there's the force that a person can feel and exist and can work with and strengthen their awareness of. But then there's a force that lies beyond that force user that they can tap into that, you know, it's connected to all other force users and even what is beyond that. And I don't know what that is called. But that's where my Star Wars awareness ends and maybe yours begins.
It's a good line. With spring arriving, that means Passover. It's right around the corner. To help provide you insights and more into Jewish drinking at this time of year, where else to turn to than jewishdrinking.com? In addition to multiple episodes over the course of multiple years of episodes of the Jewish Drinking Show, there are also resources at jewishdrinking.com to provide insights, whether it's articles and more. Feel free to check out jewishdrinking.com/Passover to check out those resources. L'chaim.
And the Blessed Divine has compassion towards us and grants us the ability to receive this illumination in a holy way. And this is the primary quality of redemption. Therefore, we need to specifically drink wine, which elevates the mind beyond its state. Mm-hmm. So just to end here, that this is not only, this is not solely just someone drinking to a point where they can tap into this awareness, bring it back with them. It reifies their commitment to mitzvot and to this way of life. But there is something about what I would call grace, that we are being held by divinity in this process, and to do it in kedusha, right? This is not a flippant, arrogant, abusive way of drinking wine, but this is specifically for the purpose of kedusha. Specifically, right, daika here, specifically through wine, which that is the vehicle for the elevation of the mind from the mind.
You know what? I'm catching a little bit of interesting language going on. I don't know if I know the English translation stops, but I'm fascinated because he starts mentioning drunkenness, and obviously he's got warning signs popping up, basically. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a fascinating aspect of this, of the discourse here. I don't know if you want to go into that at all.
Yeah, please.
That's an important piece.
Well, why don't you here? Why don't you take over? I've done some here, and I have a longer translation of this whole piece, of course, but I just didn't include it in this particular Doc Makoro for I don't even remember what reason. It was already 2 years ago. But great.
I'm going to push you to go back and edit and pop
Thank
that
you.
Translation Thank you. In. So he mentions he's concerned about wine. I'm sorry, drunkenness. He says through wine drinking and then drunkenness, you can screw up a lot of things. And then he mentions this verse from Mishlei, Yitain because eino yitalech b'meisharim. And wine and Mishlei, he's concerned because the author of Mishlei, of Proverbs, he's all about being productive member of society. And so sleep and drunkenness are not, he's not fond of. So he has a concern here. Shekol ha-drachim doma alav kemishor, all pathways are comparable. Mm-hmm. Then he talks about the mocho. Is this the mind, the mind, the kli, the moch, and shalot? All these warnings of the mitzvahs of Moshe. Anyways, that somehow through drunkenness he forgot all the Moses warnings. Wait, Moses forgot them, or someone else forgot the warnings?
Sha'al yedei shichrus shocheach kol ha'azharot shel Moshe. No, so
Then who forgot?
Why
the drinker?
Well, the drinker.
Oh, the drinker forgot them.
The drinker, if one drank outside of this, what we would call set and setting, right? This container for experience. Once someone goes to 4.5 or 5, or you know, beyond the arba kosot, that when it gets into shichrut, then that is when someone could forget that they're azharot of the Torah. Someone could forget specifically what happened with the Nadav and Abihu.
You think that's what he's referencing?
Nadav and Abihu. I know that he references this later and. I'm also bringing in some of the things specifically from Chabad, where wine is talked about as a vehicle for mystical intellection and for the revealing of secrets. But the Azharot, no, is specifically just about the Lavin or the Torah.
Oh, so the proscriptive commandments.
Yes, for the negative commandments. That one could potentially break if they find themselves in a state of drunkenness versus wine as a vehicle for mystical elevation. Ascension, we'll call it ascension or elevation.
Yeah. And then he mentions later on that through drunkenness, you can screw up your mind until he's not listening to any warnings and he's just like a plank or plane. Right. So he basically says you can elevate yourself, you can ascend through wine drinking, but drunkenness, you've gone too far.
Right.
But it's really fascinating what you were mentioning, that this piece about these, I guess, these proscriptions in the Torah, the prescriptive commandments or the warnings. Is that the same thing? You're saying that's similar? Same thing?
I think the azharot of the Torah that he is mentioning are the azharot shel hamitzvot shel Moshe Rabbeinu. I believe that these are the negative commandments, that a person could easily break negative commandments in a state of drunkenness. They can, easier to stop keeping kosher or any, sexual morality or breaking property, destroying property or anything else, that is possible when one takes drinking too far, as we would say in the business, kiyadua, right? That's obvious.
Yeah.
So, like how much is too much? That's the question, that he leaves us with is there's intentionality. There's the ability for it to be a spiritual practice. That is done for a specific purpose, at least here in this case. But we know that not all use of substance is substantial that it can lead to great negative effects in people's lives in the short term and in the long term. Mm-hmm. So again, I mean that is certainly for my purposes, right? Because we know from good research that most substances which are called psychedelics cannot harm us in the ways that we were taught in school, like through, you know, DARE. I don't know if you were a DARE kid. I was a DARE kid.
DARE worked on me.
And
DARE worked.
It worked.
That's why I've never smoked a thing in my life.
DARE. Well, that's why I had not used psychedelics until 2017. You know, I was afraid of turning into a cup of orange juice, or that my DNA would get fried and my children would have you know, terrible birth defects. And it turned out that most of this was a lie. And even, you know what, DARE, it turns out that the greatest impact that DARE had on most people.
I'm very curious.
Teaching kids about drugs and how to use them. So more people, okay. More people learned about drugs because of DARE than drug abstinence, which is just so crazy. That's so funny. The living legacy of these programs was to introduce drugs to kids. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know that if you tell kids about drugs, that they're going to want to use them as opposed to not use them. but most of the things that they told us were just not true. Hmm. In terms of toxicity, in terms of changing your DNA, in terms of people, you know, just losing their minds after using LSD once. Mm. Of course, there are certainly situations that people who have a history of mental illness, bipolar, other like very intense mental illness. These things can. You know, these things can trigger major events, and those people should obviously refrain from that. Mm-hmm. But by and large, in terms of just toxicity, it's just been shown that these things have very low toxicity and can really not harm you. Mm-hmm. Different from alcohol, which is probably one of the great killers of drugs and medicine. So, mm-hmm. You know, again, like Ravnasan was saying, like there's a place and a time and a container, and going beyond that can be deleterious, but maybe not inside it.
That's fair. So wrapping up the particular text here, so it's got using it advantageously. I mean, obviously for him, the four cups are there. Now he's saying, how can this be? What's the instrumentality? What's the advantageous aspect of deploying it? And then also, be careful about too much. Also too much for him is a problem, which I imagine I'm very curious to explore that more in Hasidic thought more broadly, or even within his. I think I'm super curious and fascinated. Mm-hmm. Particular, maybe a potential future episode. But so obviously for the alcohol, that's a very clear. He's talking about alcohol. He's talking about wine, but. The connection you're saying here also more broadly with other drugs and so forth is you can use them for an advantageous aspect, but also be weary, leery of too much.
Now, my question really is like, is this a model and other texts that exist, but we're just only looking at one, have time for one. Is this a model for how Jewish individuals and communities potentially could think about psychedelic use as a vehicle for spiritual development, for you know, at the betterment of well people, as some people say, that in a particular setting, let's say with trained mashpi'im, with guides, with supportive music in a setting that a person, you know, can feel free to explore within, but is not, you know, walking into traffic, or is even, you know, it, or, is in a car, but is in a loving, caring environment where people are going to make sure that they are safe and that those people are also of the highest ethical order and not taking advantage of people, because that's another concern, is not just the drugs themselves, but in the environment where people are very suggestible, they're open to suggestion, they're very vulnerable, that God forbid that the people who are supposed to be taking care of them and keeping them safe have less than pure intentions also. So it is, is this a possibility for religious people or spirit, you know, Jewish spiritual people, or even atheists, Jewish atheists who want to deepen their relationship with their Judaism in some way? And I think maybe. do we even need a text? Do we even need a source? It's been my experience that people need sources. I'm much more on the David Hartman end of innovation. Like, if it works, I don't need a proof text.
In addition to the many and plentiful resources that exist on JewishDrinking.com, whether it's secondary literature, fascinating insights, in addition to the really cool podcast, The Jewish Drinking Show, did you know that you can also provide interesting opportunities for your synagogue, JCC organization? And yes, that's me, bringing Rabbi Drew to help bring L'chaims to life, whether beer in the Bible, whether it's various Talmudic drinking stories, and more. I'm happy to chat, to talk to you, talk to your synagogue, your organization, your JCC, whatever it is. Feel free to reach out to me at drew@jewishdrinking.com and see how we can bring L'chaims to life.
The work that I've been doing with psychedelics specifically, so, you know, my organization, Shefa, was founded when, in 2017, I was a participant in a research study where different faith leaders were given, in a safe, supported, and scientific setting, were given high doses of psilocybin, which is the active compound in magic mushrooms. And I was given this twice on two different occasions. And the question was, now that it has been established by certain institutions that psilocybin can create or occasion mystical type experiences, right? They've been able to quantify and qualify what is a mystical experience. Mm-hmm. Now that they were able to establish that almost 20 years ago, what would happen if we gave faith leaders, people who have a rich vocabulary about their inner world, they're connected to their traditions, right? This isn't just, you know, psychedelics and drugs and cool and amazing and vibes. This is people who are dedicated to a particular tradition and they work inside their community. What would happen if we gave these people this, this medicine or this compound? How would that shift or change their inner life, their desire to be working in their community? Any particular insights that they might have about their inner world, their tradition, or what it means to be in their particular vocation. And this was my first psychedelic experience. The only reason that I was able to be in the study was because I had not had any prior psychedelic experience, but it wasn't my first mystical experience. I grew up when I was 15 years old. I had a major, overpowering, overwhelming, and life-transforming mystical experience as a kid on an Israel trip. I was 15, had no prior experience with mitzvot or religiosity in my Reform upbringing, and suddenly all the lights went on. I knew that there was Hashem in the world, that Hashem wanted to have a relationship with me, and the way that we mitigated that relationship was through mitzvot and Talmud Torah. And so I just completely far left turn from my family and everything that I had been brought up with. And I followed this for years and years and years and made Torah and divine service central to my life. But at this point in 2017, things started to slow down for reasons that I won't get into. But after the fact, after these two major experiences, it just came to me that if this is something that is going to gain more mainstream recognition, that over time laws will change, you know, you're starting to see even now just more in that you just mentioned before we started recording, things about psychedelic assisted therapy and John Oliver on HBO. You know, every other week there's like a thing in the news, psychedelics can, may, will treat some other malady. Mm-hmm. But the question is, if these things can create authentic religious experiences, what will happen when Jewish people start doing this more often?
Mm.
They already do, by the way. And they actually want it to somehow help develop their relationship to Judaism, or they want to help heal intergenerational trauma as a Jew. And I was looking and looking for some help to help me answer these questions and couldn't find much. So I founded Shefa. And today, Shefa is an organization dedicated to creating powerful pathways to the heart of Jewish wisdom, practice, and community inspired by the contemporary psychedelic renaissance. But there was just one issue that drug use, psychedelics, according to my understanding of things, have not been part of a continuous lineage of how Jews have done spiritual practice for the past 2,000 years or so. Some people do think it's there somewhere, burning bush, manna, what's happening in Har Sinai. People seem to, you know, find psychedelics in every parak of the Chumash. I don't. But I still want to find models for how what we would call exogenous, things that exist outside the human body, how exogenous materials like wine or like mushrooms or like, you know, cacti could actually change one's inner life and actually have them have some insight about the nature of reality or consciousness, some insight about their relationship between the Kodesh Baruch Hu and them. And it's actually really hard to find. But I have found a couple sources that I think are helpful guides. Some of them are about achieving trance states, but not through anything other than their own breath or meditation or stress positions. But I am continuing to find sources like the one that we're going to learn today that talks about wine as not just the markers of different points in the Seder, or to mention, you know, the particular promises that the Kadosh Baruch Hu gives to Moshe and the Jewish people about taking them out of Egypt, but about as catalysts for achieving a new kind of consciousness that only happens at the Seder, that then is applied after the Seder itself. So that's what I wanted to share with you. Thank God for Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Thank God for Rav Nassim.
I wanted to break in really briefly. I'm Rabbi Drew, your host and founder of JewishDrinking.com. Turns out, as of this fall, the IRS has recognized Jewish Drinking as a 501c3 organization. You are always welcome to make donations. If you have any questions how to do so, you can check out the website or even simply email me at drew@JewishDrinking.com. Thank you. Now back into the show. Rabbi Kamenetz, this has been fascinating, insightful, hopefully helping us prepare for the Seder. Before we go, is there anything you would like to promote?
People can check out our work at www.shefa, S-H-E-F-A, flow, F-L-O-W, shefaflow.org. Unfortunately, shefa.org was taken. But people can sign up for our classes. We have integration circles where people who have used psychedelics in the past are looking for Jewish spaces to talk about, make meaning, of their experiences with other Jewish people, and you learn about everything that we're working on and through.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kamenetz, and L'chaim.
L'chaim. Shabbat.